Go on then.
Well, go on what?
You're going to play that thing.
Oh, we actually. All right.
Yeah.
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 Okay. So we're sitting around in our house and we've got a guest. She's come all the way from Brighton, which I believe is about 7 miles to the west. We're going to talk to her about things that have happened in the present and also in the past. On the Indelicate Live Jukebox Podcast. Problem with doing an introduction in the style of Van Morrison is the Van Morrison songs, they go on and 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 on. And if we do that, then the podcast will be much too long. It'll be just sort of 3 hours of me going round and round making up a bad Van Morrison song. So let's stop. Yeah, that was our idea for an introduction to the podcast. We do it in the style of Van Morrison.
That's excellent.
Yeah, I think it goes on a bit. We'll do it in the style of someone else next week.
Yes. Stay tuned.
Hey, we're back.
Hello, we're back.
And we've got a guest again. This is our third guest now. You're our third guest.
Oh,
and the first question I'm going to ask you is from our last guest, Lily Ray. Would like to know why your publisher didn't give her a job.
Oh, well, I can't really say.
Because our guest this week has got a publisher and everything. She's got one of these useless sort of guests we've had before. She's got a proper book out and she's won a prize and all that stuff.
Yes.
Multiple prizes, probably.
Three
prizes. That's loads of prizes. It's Ros Barber, ladies and gentlemen.
Hooray!
Yay! Ros
Barber.
Hello,
hello.
And you wrote a book.
I did. Yeah, well, I wrote
2 years ago?
Well,
you wrote it over several years.
Yeah, I did.
Did it come out this year or last year?
It came out last year in hardback. It's called The Marlowe Papers.
And what is it about?
Well, it's a fictional autobiography of the 16th century playwright Christopher Marlowe, based on the extremely unpopular theory that he wrote the works attributed to William Shakespeare.
Is it extremely unpopular?
Well,
I suppose it's not as popular.
In English departments.
Yes. Yeah,
it was really unpopular while I was doing, you know, writing the book as part of a PhD in an English department, mm-hmm. mixing with other academics. It's not very popular with English professors and the like.
No.
But, you know,
that's just nonsense, isn't it?
We're not going to go straight into that.
No,
we've got to warm up first.
We'll warm up. We'll talk about other
things. It's fiction. It's fiction, all right? It's a fictional, but it's a novel, so.
Yeah. And it's because I've known you for a very long time.
Yes.
How long? I don't know how long we've known Ros.
I'm wondering.
You must have known Ros longer than I have.
It's
You've known
least,
Ros longer than we've been doing music.
Oh, it's 12
thing.
Years, 13 years, something like that.
God, I must have been extremely young.
You were.
And precocious.
And irritating. Well, you must have been pretty young.
We were all a lot younger.
That's the thing about time. Is that it has this arrow-like direction.
Yeah, but you were properly young. You were a lot younger than me. You were in your early 20s.
And Julia wasn't even born.
I can't have been that young.
You've been, well, I suppose, 18. I don't know when you met Ros the first time, but you were 19 when I met you and I was 20.
I don't know, do you come to the Poetry Slam or did you?
I saw you at a poetry thing. I don't think it was the Poetry Slam. I saw you at
the Sanctuary. Yeah, so
well,
you will have met me when I was 19, I think.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Teenager.
Yeah.
Wow.
Awful teenager.
No, you're all right.
But yes, we've known each other a long
yeah.
time.
Because I feel I've started this podcast on quite a professional note. I went straight into questions. And
yes.
That. And actually, it's more of a kind of casual, I don't really mind what we say. So it's like, it doesn't have to be all proper.
Okay.
We can just sort of go on about stuff.
All right, like we normally do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because we were talking the other day, because when I met, the reason I know you and Julia and pretty much everyone in my life in Brighton, at least, is because one day I got up in the morning and I thought, oh, I'm really bored. I'm going to go to Seven Dials, which I've never been to before, and look around it. And this was like when I was, I suppose, in my second year at university or something. And I'm just going to walk around and I wasn't really, for no reason, and I could easily have not done that. And then when I was there, I met David Hunter, who I'd never really spoken to before. And then I think that afternoon we went back to his flat and decided to plan a poetry revolution that we were going to have. And literally from that, like, I know Julia, I know you, I know everyone in Brighton, that, like, the whole rest of my life was entirely dependent on me bothering to get out of bed on one day when I probably wouldn't have done.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
It's beautiful, really.
But it's sort of, it's just sort of a bit disturbing.
That it might not have happened.
Like, I don't know, I've literally no idea. I mean, because, you know, I'm married to you, been in a band for the last 8 years, which is entirely dependent on that. Yeah. And I just, nothing in my life would be the same at all based on one tiny, utterly inconsequential decision. Because I think some decisions you make, it kind of, you'll be, you know, you would always have made that decision because that's the kind of makeup of the sort of person you are. And it might have felt like a decision, but actually, but this one really could have gone either way. There was really no reason for me to go out.
Don't
or I could have gone somewhere else.
Don't you think you might have bumped into David Hunter at some other... if it hadn't been that day, it would have been another day.
That's what I think, yeah.
But he's a very fickle and rude man.
Yeah. You're a perfect match.
And, well, yeah, but...
Because you could put up with it.
But, I mean, on another day, he might not have been interested in talking to people in the street.
No.
I mean, I just... Because I think it was that particular week, like, that he... been thinking, oh, I really ought to start a poetry revolution with someone. And
and it was you.
And, you know, yeah, I was the kind of person who was likely to go, yeah, that's a really good idea, let's do that. We'll be the new...
But we need some girls.
And then we said one day, you know, this poetry revolution, it's going to stumble without any girls.
Yeah.
And we met Julia that night.
And you roped her in.
Yeah,
and And we didn't change the world. We ended up changing ourselves.
You should have said that in a film trailer way.
Yeah, but I can't
really
pull
that
off.
He's about to find out.
So, but then how do I know you?
Can
you remember?
Well, I got connected to the same group of poets through Paul.
Yeah.
So through Paul?
Just through Paul, yeah.
Because he used to know David Hunter and he used to go to all those things. And we weren't an item at that point, but I had just moved back to Brighton and was looking for a way to meet other people who were doing the poetry thing. And he was organising something. Oh, that's right. I met Justin first.
Right.
I met Justin.
Could have been a Justin.
I met Justin and Justin said...
That is a cruel laugh, you just...
Sorry, I didn't mean it.
I could have been with Justin, depending on what he decided.
That's true. But Justin said, oh, I've got this mate and he runs a night at Borders and would you do a reading for him? And he wouldn't pay you anything, but would that be okay? And I said, yeah, and that's how we met. Mm-hmm. That's how I met Paul. And then he said, we were friends for quite a while before we got together. And during that time, I met you, I met the Reverend and met Julia and the whole crew, everybody.
You met B as well, didn't you? Met B.
Well, I knew B for, because, I mean, obviously all these are just people who mean nothing to people who are listening. But B,
is
B on
this? This is the trouble. We're just having a chat, aren't we?
No, that's good. That's fine. they don't mind. They like to feel, you know, they're part of something. Very sad, lonely people sat alone.
Probably the most interesting.
If we leave a gap every few minutes, they can say something on their own.
Okay,
and
so they can
feel
join
like
in.
They have friends. It's
all
few,
right.
Yeah. It's all right, Peter. We'll just.
This is basically. You've got to stop offending people. This is by things.
No, I feel I'm okay because I'm nice to Peter Murrells on the internet in the week, and then I feel I can be mean to him on the podcast.
Okay.
I should stop. I don't mean it, Peter. You're only doing this because I like you. I like Peter Murrells.
I know you do.
I shouldn't have to spell that out. He knows.
He knows.
It's just because Campbell said, my friend Campbell came, he listened to the podcast and he said, you're being very mean about this Peter Murrells character. And I was like, I had to explain that.
It's going
to
become a theme.
But the thing is, Peter Murrells, he requested, because you know, you can request us to play songs on this podcast. That's the thing. It's like a jukebox and you can queue it up.
Yeah.
And he requested, I think, the worst song we've ever done. So I do hate him for a good reason. Because I had to play that and it was really bad and I
but
felt
you like
embarrassed.
We haven't yet put that one out there, so. Well, no,
you got to do meta thinking to.
Yeah.
This podcast is in the far future.
It is.
I haven't released the one before this yet.
No.
Okay.
But we're gonna. So the idea was that you would perform or read something because we quite like to have Paul on, but unless he's going to perform something,
no.
What else is he going to do?
No, he didn't do that performance thing anymore.
He could present radio yes. program for a little bit. Yeah. People have to do the thing they do on the podcast yes. to fill space. But
yeah, I can read.
I think that'd be really good. Yeah, we could go straight on with that, couldn't we? Yeah, that'd be lovely.
All right, then. I'll read the opening because it's the opening.
Because this is the American copy of your book, isn't it?
This is the American copy of my book, yeah.
Which is flimsier.
It's well, actually, the one that's out there...
I have the English hardback, which is very sturdy.
It's very sturdy. Well, this is the advanced reader copy of the American one, so it's very floppy.
So has it got harder words for advanced readers?
No, but they have got a hardback out, so that's...
Right, yeah.
But it's not, still not as sturdy as the...
No.
As the English one, British one. Okay, so this is the opening. It begins the day that most... Marlowe biographies and fictions indeed end, which is the 30th of May 1593, when Marlowe is supposed to have died in a fight in Mrs. Bull's house in Deptford, stabbed through the eye.
I haven't actually mentioned that it's in verse yet.
It is in verse.
It's a novel in verse, and this is why that should not put you off.
Yes.
It's really good. And
yeah, just pretend we didn't say that. A lot of people just switched off there.
Really? Well. In that case, we can start discussing all that controversial stuff.
All that controversial
stuff. The Microsoft.
Okay, yeah. We'll get onto that anyway, won't we?
We won't. It's what we always do, and pause it and then come back on and laugh.
Yes, good. All right, now it's in verse, it's in iambic pentameter, and it's Marlowe's story. He's telling his story of how he didn't really die. He faked his own death to avoid charges of atheism and heresy, which would have caused him to be tortured and executed. So on the day he's meant to have died, he's actually escaping to the continent into exile. Here we are. Death's a great disguiser. Church dead. And not a headstone in my name. No brassy plaque, no monument, no tomb, no whittled initials on a makeshift cross, no pile of stones upon a mountaintop. The plague is the excuse. The age's curse that swells to life as spring gives way to summer, to sun, unconscious kisser of a warmth that wakens canker as it wakens bloom. Now fear infects the wind, and every breath that neighbour breathes on neighbour in the street brings death so close you smell it on the stairs. Rats multiply, as God would have them do, and fear infects like mould, like fungus spreads. Folk catch it from the chopped-off ears and thumbs, the burning heretics and eyeless heads that slow revolve the poles on London Bridge. The child of casual violence grows inured, an audience too used to real blood. They've watched a preacher, butchered, still awake, and handed his beating heart like it was love. And now the sanctioned butchery of state breeds sadists who delight to man the rack, reduce men from divine belief and brain to begging and the rubble of their spines. From all this I am dead, reduced to ink that magics up my spirit from the page, a voice who knows what mortals cannot think of, a ghost whose words ring deeper from the grave. Corpse dead, a gory stab hole for an eye, and that's what they must think. No, must believe, those thug-head pursers bent on gagging speech, if I'm to slip their noose and stay alive. Now I'm as dead as any to the world, the foulest rain of blackened corpses on the body that has entered in my name, the plague pit where Kit Marlowe now belongs. For who could afford for that infected earth to be dug up to check identities? And so I leave my former name behind. Gone on the Deptford tide, the whole world blind. Friend, I'm no one. If I write to you in fading light that distances the threat, it's as a breeze that strokes the channel's waves, the spray that blesses some small vessel's deck.
Very nice.
Excellent.
Thank you.
What is it about iambic pentameter that makes it better than other measures?
It's the extra foot.
It's the extra foot.
I agree. Because tetrameter is da di dum 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 di dum. It's greetings card verse, and it's, you know, comic verse. It's light verse. I mean, I have written some serious tetrameter just to try and prove that you could write serious tetrameter, but it's harder to make it serious. Whereas the extra foot in pentameter,
I suppose it's that comic swift, like the kind of Swift and Pope used it.
You just get the association,
which sort of which works, but it has always got that air of
lightness,
of, like even when it's deadly serious, it's got like, it's kind of that detached motionless, whereas there's a real stateliness to it.
That's it sounds noble, doesn't it?
It does, like... and of course, it does. It is so strongly associated with Shakespeare. And
is that why it sounds noble, or is it noble innately?
I think it's innately noble.
I do too.
I think it's innately noble, and then you know, I mean, and I think that's why Shakespeare used it because it was terrific for, you know, it has that kind of sonorous depth and quality to it. But
do you think you've got, what would you say, okay, this is, you probably don't have an answer to this, but is there one line in the whole book that you think that is a damn fine piece of pentameter?
One line?
Well, I've seen people talk about, like, Shakespeare saying his best line is in Lear, where it's just never five times, because it is like this sort of uniquely perfect use of the form is just to say never five times, but within the context of pentameter it kind of really asserts exactly what he's trying to say, which is this finality of death and all that stuff. But I just wonder if there's one, because I know
there's something very similar in it, in that there's a, because I did, you know, read the whole, and you know, read, watch, listen to the entire canon of Shakespeare and Marlowe, and so I use a lot of, there's a lot of references and tricks, and there is a line where Marlowe is trying to, he's just sort of lost and trying to remember why he's bothering still existing, really, because he's also quite, you know, he's kind of on the edge and thinking, you know, the life's not worth it anymore. He says that he forgets and then he remembers, you know, in terms of what his purpose is and why he should bother keep going on. And there's just a line that says, to write, to write, to write, to write, to write. So, very similar thing.
I think if you can get to the point, where you're ripping off Shakespeare in a kind of, but not directly, but in a way that you're ripping off Shakespeare's stylistic emphasis, then I think you've done it right.
I do that in quite a few places in the book. In fact, you don't have to know anything. You don't have to be at all familiar with the Shakespeare canon or know anything about Marlowe to get into the book and to understand it. It sort of works on its own. But if you are a bit of a Shakespeare buff, there's loads of sort of in jokes and references and pleasurable little things that you can pick up on. So a lot of people, I mean, even Professor Stanley Wells and Dr. Paul Emerson, the Reverend Dr. Paul Emerson of the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, who obviously are very much against the underlying premise of the book.
Of course.
Both really loved the book and have said so publicly.
That's really good.
Yeah, because you know, if you really know your Shakespeare, there's an awful lot of joy in them picking up on the little
things. Is there any incredibly obscure reference that's in there no one's, to your knowledge, ever noticed, and does that annoy you? Because I've got things like that with the band that I'll put in stuff. Because I always get really narrowed in, and there'll be things like on the David Koresh Superstar, there's like a video that we did. And at the beginning, there's an evidence plate, like the FBI would put, saying like the exhibit number and everything. Yeah. And in the corner, there is a coat of arms with like, it's kind of the FBI's coat of arms with a thing with a bit of Latin on it. And the Latin is "We hate the kids" in Latin. Uh-huh. And I don't think anyone
has
ever gone, paused that video for the sort of 5 seconds it's on screen and go, oh, what's that? Latin, I wonder what that means. Oh, brilliant.
That's because no one is quite as nerdy as you,
Simon. No one gives a toss. But this is what I'm trying to find out. Are you as nerdy? Is there anything obscure like that that people haven't noticed?
Well, I wouldn't...
I mean, I could ask you about general themes and characters stuff, but I'm sure, you know, well, read the book for that.
What I would say is I wouldn't know... I put in quite a lot of really, really... you know, tiny little detailed things, and I don't know if there's any that haven't been picked up on, because, you know, people, there's 72,000 words.
Yeah.
So sometimes
do you not issue tests to people? You should do that, I think.
I've had some people say, oh, I really love this bit, and I've really, oh, and I like that, and I've got the joke, and, you know, so people tell me when they've got certain things, but I haven't checked them all off on a checklist, so I don't know which ones haven't been picked up on. I reckon if Stanley Wells and Paul Emerson have got them, they've picked up.
Tell me a good one.
They've quite
Tell me a really obscure one.
Oh, God, no, off the top of my head. They will all be references to plays and I can't think of a really. I mean, maybe the marigold thing. There are people that would get the marigold thing. There's an engraving. I might have put it in the notes. That's the other thing. I've got all these notes in the back, and so people can go and look things up. So
they won't know, will they? Idiots.
But there's, you know, there's a marigold engraving on one of the copies of Hero and Leander that has this Latin. And so you're going back to Latin, this Latin inscription. Now that's actually used, but the significance of the marigold is only hinted at in the text, and there's another level of it that's a bit more subtle that only some people would get, and only if they've read a particular essay.
And do they get a prize?
Yeah.
They should get a prize.
Yeah, all right.
Simon wants a prize.
I just want to turn
all the hard work.
I want to turn all art into games.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I could have done a quiz if I had a bit
I'm
more
trying to think of
time
more,
to prepare.
I'm trying to think of Marlowe Papers questions that you just wouldn't be asked. Right, okay, so how do Marlovians drive their cars, and how is that different to the way Oxfordians drive their cars? So Marlovians drove their cars like, if it was stand-up, if it was bad stand-up.
I can't.
And you have to translate the action you would do in the bad stand-up into a description that works in an audio format.
Oh, well, that's too complicated for me. I don't know that they drive their cars any differently, Simon, do they?
Oh, I'm sure they do. There's got to be a different kind of person that's an Oxfordian. Because I think Oxfordians are disgusting snobs.
Well, I think the snobbery argument is I don't think that holds. My feeling is, I know that there are a lot of noble candidates and that snobbery is the main thing that's thrown against it. But it seems to me that Oxford's the most popular candidate and most of the stuff out there is Oxfordian. If you have any doubts about Shakespeare being the author of Stratford being the author of his own works, Oxford's the one you tend to land upon. And so I think that, you know, doubters go to Oxford just sort of almost by default because there's just so much Oxfordian stuff out there.
It's Oxford, but I think, in the film, isn't it?
In Anonymous. Yeah. Do we have to talk about that? Because I had to drink half a bottle of wine to watch it, you know?
It's fine.
I refused to go and see it at the cinema only because it didn't come to Brighton, and I thought I have to go to Crawley, and then it's just going, really, I'm going to so much trouble to see this film that that I know is going to be awful. So I thought I'll wait for it to come out on DVD, and then I got it on Love Film, it came through. I started watching it and I got so angry in the first 15 minutes that I had to turn it off and have a sort of rant at Paul about it.
Which film was this again?
Anonymous.
Anonymous.
And then, but the next time I thought, but I know I have to watch it because people are going to ask me, and people were already asking me, what do you think about Anonymous? I was like, well, I have to watch the damn thing all the way through. So the second night...
To be honest, I didn't really ask you, I just assumed you hated it.
Well, I just opened a bottle of wine and drank as much of that as I could stomach before putting the DVD on. And then it was, a ridiculous, entertaining romp with it. It was the ahistoricism of it that really got me. It was the complete lack of adherence to historical fact, because when I wrote the Marlowe Papers, what I did do was try and, you know, have a basic sort of skeleton of actual established historical facts that I could then put a flesh, you know, build the flesh on the bones, but I wasn't going to alter the bones. And I think the problem with Anonymous is it really does in the most ridiculous way. It doesn't even have Marlowe dying in 1593. It has him dying later than that and killed by Shakespeare, which is just
really
stupid.
With a gun.
With a gun
that fires
the laser gun.
Yeah. With a dubstep gun. There's a game that's come out with a dubstep gun. It's the best thing I've ever heard of.
Okay.
No, it's a gun that fires dubstep.
I don't really understand that, Simon.
You know, dubstep. It's the kids.
Yeah. I don't connect with the kids, Simon. I'm old. I'm so far from my 20s now.
Oh, well. Yeah, the kids ought to like that. In America, kids go for it. Like, they prefer old things.
Yeah.
There's a different
culture. I'm almost retro. I see these music posters, and they say all the music that they're going to be playing. And these are complicated labels. And I look at these things, I have no idea what that would be.
Even young people don't like the music they've got now. Even the people who like that music don't really like it.
I don't even understand the labels. I just go...
Well, dubstep goes... It's brilliant. You should check it out.
I could see how that could be a weapon.
Slowed down dance music with toilety sounds and stuff.
It's not like toilet... You love dubstep.
I love it, yeah. It's brilliant. It sounds angry like all good new music should, but it's dance. It's essentially electronic dance music.
Okay.
But it is brutal, and you could
kill someone with it.
If Shakespeare was using a gun that fired it to kill Marlo. I imagine that would be awesome.
Do you reckon that... I was just trying to think of places where I've heard iambic pentameter from people on TV. I'm just wondering if any of the, like, any of the president's speeches in the West Wing
have been secretly using
just because I was trying to think of people who, yeah, people who use the extra foot for that.
It's easy to speak in iambic pentameter, and when I was writing the book, I was speaking and thinking in it all the time, quite accidentally.
Yeah, and yeah, I bet. Yeah, from
it's quite natural to speak in that.
Nothing to fear but fear itself.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of what
well,
I was. That's
not quite.
Nothing
to fear but fear itself. But
it's not long enough.
It's not long enough. But in terms of it does
the stars, the stars ones, the one that's always in the West Wing. You
which
know,
one?
The,
oh, I was using a real speech. Yeah,
something. Yeah, reach for the stars. No, something reach up to the stars. I can't remember what it is, but it. I think
and
it
touch
is.
Touch the face of God. Yeah.
You reach your hands.
But that's a quote from.
It is, yes. Yeah, so
it's a quote from a poem, and I have a
quote from that poem.
Maybe that's yeah.
Okay. What is it from? It's... Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to remember it now. We can look it up. Look it up. You've got the internet. You've downloaded this off it. Look it up yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. Said about everything.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, this is why, basically, talking about things pointless on a podcast. just if there's anything we're having... If you should have asked that.
Okay.
Just look it up.
Yeah. All right, then.
Yeah.
Should we have a little break for a song?
You are supposed to play a song, aren't you? Mm. What's been requested this week? In
Roses.
The Ooh, what's that about?
what is it about?
You know what it's about.
I don't really remember. What's it about?
It's about murdering Tasha Khan.
No, it isn't.
It is about that. It's clearly about that.
No, it isn't. All right.
Yes.
Okay, I had to practice this especially for... Who was it for?
It's about a variety of women called Rose, isn't it?
No, it isn't.
But that would work, wouldn't it, interestingly?
Yeah, probably, in a poetry way or something. Andrew Lane.
Andrew Lane.
Yeah.
I mean, do we hate this one? Because all the other ones we've played so far, we've hated and not wanted to play because we disagree with their content.
Well, this is from the second album, and probably it's okay. I don't think the vocal performance is particularly good.
On the
but
recording.
I will try and improve it a little bit on the podcast, hopefully. Maybe. We'll
have
see.
A go.
Thank you. everything this time.
Good. I think that is the key to not sucking.
Because
we didn't practice on the other ones, did we? Yeah. So in the future, we will practice.
Yeah. So that's the song about death.
What do you feel about the video to that song now? Because it's a really good video, isn't it? But you think everyone misunderstands it and thinks you're just floating about when actually you're criticising things.
I don't really know what the video's about anymore, I don't think. What is it about?
Well, it's about murdering Natasha Khan, isn't it? You're allowed to say that. Yeah. It's obvious you hate her.
Well, it's not really about hatred, it's about...
It's about, if you're going to ban Pan for page three, you also have to ban that.
I think what it's about is, if you're going to be all mysterious and stuff, either follow through or don't a little bit.
Because like, so, what it is, it's about being mysterious and accidentally raising up Lovecraftian gods.
Yeah.
Which then kill you, and that being just...
Yeah.
Should be sat there with your books.
Yeah. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
I should probably mention I didn't really write it. So
you did write it.
Well, I wrote music.
And I just added the Lovecraft element later.
Yes, yes. Simon added the clever
to make
stuff.
The sort of two or three people who care about that happy.
Yeah. So that's that one.
Yes.
I've got some questions that I wrote out that are terrible, just in case this didn't go very well, but it's going fine, so I don't think I need to ask them, but I might read them to you because they're really bad.
Are they really bad?
Yeah. Opinion on Virginia Woolf.
My opinion on Virginia Woolf. I share a birthday with Virginia Woolf.
Oh, you poor thing. That's my opinion on Virginia
I share one with Thatcher.
Yeah, Simon
That's
wins.
That's so fitting. Yeah, Simon does win. Well, I tell you, there is a connection between me and Virginia Woolf in that I made sure, I actually went to church in a kind of I'm a liar kind of way. I went to church for 6 months. In the little church behind her house at Rockmill, behind Monk's house, in order to get married in the church behind Virginia Woolf's house.
Wow.
I went.
How did that marriage
every
turn
Sunday
out?
Not so well. Not so good, Simon, actually.
No,
yeah,
that would be a lesson to you.
Yeah, exactly. And I used to fairly religiously, and I don't use that word lightly, do the walk that she must have taken down to the river from there to kill herself.
Did she kill herself then?
Yeah, she put brilliant. Stones in her pockets and drowned in the river Ouse, walking down from Rodmell. And I used to do that walk quite frequently. I felt a real connection with her because I was very depressed for a very long time. So,
right.
And I read her diaries as well as her novels. And I rather like Virginia Woolf, I have to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that didn't go the way you wanted it to.
No. I'm interested in other opinions about things that I do not like. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to remember which was the book that really turned me on to Virginia Woolf. But as usual, I've gone blank. You see, I'm put under pressure. Being
it's
like
there aren't
an exam.
Any.
No. It was Mrs. Dalloway. I loved Mrs. Dalloway. There we are. I loved Mrs. Dalloway. And from there, that was the beginning. That was the beginning for me.
Did you say hers was the best female poetess suicide?
Or Sylvia.
Well, she took cookies to sleeping children and then did herself in the oven.
Oh, that's just too horrible.
Yeah, that's
to contemplate.
In a way,
really.
It sort of trumps Virginia, because Virginia Woolf is a bit prissy. There's in the river and that. Sylvia Plath, properly awful.
Yeah, really, that's a seriously bad
I think
death.
There's a good chance that Virginia Woolf died accidentally.
No, she put stones in her pocket.
There's nothing good about her. She can't even have killed herself properly.
The river done it.
Meant to do it. I mean, she really did.
Dreadful snob, though, isn't she?
Well,
you read her on politics, and it's just awful.
She was
a product of her time.
And her class.
She was a product of her class.
Her
time had, you know, fantastically been people in it who weren't snobs.
Yeah, but you know, you can't escape your upbringing that easily, I don't think.
I think Jessica Mitford disproves that theory.
Don't get me on the Mitfords.
Well, because Jessica Mitford used to use all that stuff in order to campaign for social justice.
Yeah,
in the deep south of America. I mean, it's just like, you know, I think you can overcome it.
Well, it's what you're interested in, isn't it, Simon? It's where your passion and your focus lies, and it wasn't there if you wasn't interested.
Why can't I get you started on the Mitfords? I don't think I've ever got you started on the Mitfords.
No,
I don't know what happened.
No, we don't go there.
Really? Because I am also the kind of person who can get started on the Mitfords.
Okay.
And I'll go on about it for a while.
Why don't you go on about the Mitfords?
I think everyone knows about the Mitfords now, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. And you can, if you don't, Google it.
We wrote a song about it. Simon wrote a song about it. That is in... Is that a sonnet? It's a sonnet, isn't it? Unity Mipford. Is it a sonnet?
No, I think I worked out that New Other People was technically three sonnets, but the Unity Mipford was just lyrics.
Okay. Good lyrics, though.
I mean, they're not very formal sonnets, but
New Art for the People is three sonnets.
Mm. Sort of.
That must be why I like it so much.
New Art for People, New Art for People has a turn in it, and it is, I think it is the right division of lines for a kind of classical...
How fantastic.
I think it is 8 and 6, and I think there is a clear turn in every
As a Bolter. As a Bolter, Simon.
There is one of those.
And when you shout like
I think that it's not got a formal metre, but in terms of... In terms of structure, they do work as 8 and 6 with a turn. So.
Yeah, how difficult do you think it is to set iambic pentameter to music? Because obviously,
I think Shakespeare failed. I mean, like Shakespeare's song lyrics are kind of low points for me.
But they are, well, because you have to write in 4/4 generally, don't you?
Yeah, you do, and so I think.
And it's hard to write well in 4/4 if you write really well in. I'm a bit pentameter and used to that. It's a switch down, isn't it?
Yeah.
But then lyrics don't have to... songs can... They can be beautiful. You know, lyrics on the whole aren't... Yours are an exception, obviously, Simon, but lyrics as a whole, when you read them, are very disappointing. And they can... You can be, can be the most beautiful song, and you can think that the words feel very profound and when you're listening to the song, and then you read the lyrics off the page, you go, God, this is shit, you know? Yeah. This is really bad.
I think there probably are exceptions, but I think it's like for... Generally speaking,
lyrics are really dull, and
I still find it much easier to write short, very short poems that are very clear and very.
But Shakespeare's songs, when set to music and when done well, are beautiful. But when you read them,
they're inconsequential. I kind of think they're the least of his things.
Well, they're not. Yeah, they're the. I would say that they're apparently superficial, but there are deeper things being done.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I suppose, because I used to, when I was younger and cared about things, it used to really annoy me when people would say, oh, Dylan was a poet. Because it was kind of, and he wasn't, he was just really good at songs.
He's a lyricist.
And isn't that enough? Yes. And that sure, why is one better than the other?
Yeah.
And I don't really mind now when people say that, but it used to really annoy me. Because I think they are two very different things.
They are two very different things.
Because I think you've got access to a whole other palette when you're writing lyrics, in that you have, like, I mean, there's an example from what we've done. There's one of ours where... Like, I reference very consciously and clearly All the Young Dudes.
Yes. Right?
But the reference isn't in the word 25. I say, like, it's not that hard to stay alive when you're 25. But in the words themselves, there is no reference. The reference is all in the fact that I sort of do a bit of a David Bowie accent when I'm singing. But, like, that. But the whole content of the meaning of that is in this sort of slight affectation.
Of the performance.
The lyric itself isn't so. It's clearly not the same thing as poetry, because you don't have to force everything onto the page.
No,
you can store things in that sort of headroom you get from aspects.
With good poetry, the music has to be in the words.
Absolutely,
it has to be on the page and accessible to someone who can't hear you reading.
That's why I can't stand poetry, please, because they just they do it. They act it. It doesn't require acting. If it's well written, it doesn't require acting.
I think it requires
performance, but you should be able to read it in a straight line without adding any personality or emotion. The emotion should be there in the words, I always think. And and on Poetry Please, they're always like, oh, and they'll kind of put in these pauses which are not in the poem. I didn't need that meaning. It was there.
Have you noticed recently on the BBC, which I don't really watch the BBC channels, but they've started doing this thing where when they're interpreting someone who's in distress in a country where there's a war or something, the interpreter will act like the person on screen.
Really?
It's really weird. There was this woman crying, and they're like, oh, and it was so terrible. And you're kind of like, that's kind
what
of
are
mean.
You doing? Yeah.
Like maybe just say, I can see that she's sad, you know, like don't act.
Don't act.
I don't know, that's really weird.
I don't think I've seen people.
Yeah, it's really weird. Recently, in the last, 4 months.
Let's hope
so.
It's a passing fad.
Yeah.
And it will go.
I don't think they should be pretending
journalists to put themselves in things a lot more than they used to in the last few years. Mm. They write about themselves and generalise from their own experience in a way that I think is new, that I don't like particularly. But.
Well, I stopped buying The Guardian about 8 years ago for that reason.
Oh, good.
So it's not that new.
And yet they continue. Years ago.
Well, it was just that thing. I started, I'd only read it at the weekends. I never had time, and I'd read it sort of Saturday, whatever, Guardian. And I started thinking, this is just a bunch of personal opinions of people who don't know shit, really. They don't know more than I know. That it's an awful lot of opinion and not very much actual news. And I found it very tedious.
I think it's because I used to read the New York Times art section, because the New York Times art section had a really, like, it just for a little while was really well curated. Like they were finding things that you wouldn't hear about necessarily. Mm. And so I would read that, and then it became, there was a paywall and I couldn't access that anymore, and they probably changed the people who did it. But I do find that I kind of end up having to search a lot more for information now, interesting information about stuff, because I don't, normally there would be journalists who do this, and I don't feel like they are. I don't feel like they're writing about interesting things they found out about. I feel like they're just writing for money rather than,
I think, comment. It's, I mean, there's investigative journalism and there's commentary, and I don't really see any point in commentary.
In commentary, no, I'm really tired.
I don't really think they're more qualified. I mean, I think being 5% better at writing actually isn't, and in a way it's like the internet has exposed that market as being built on a false premise that their talent to write commentary was rare. And actually it's not particularly rare.
Anyone can do it.
Really.
Well, a lot of people.
To be honest, there's probably that 5% better you get from like a really talented columnist, but is that 5% what's required by the market? Is the market for journalism that's 5% better, or is the market just for some opinions to read? And if that, you know, so I wouldn't lament the loss of those sections from the newspapers the way that I think investigative journalism would be missed.
Well, I've completely given up on the news. I don't expose myself to the news in any form. If it comes on the radio or the TV, I switch it off. But what I do is,
I wondered why you weren't wearing your mask.
I read the week. We get the week. So I catch up on the week's news at the weekend in a very concise format where, you know, the news cycle is played out. Mm. The whole thing is developed. You get to the end. You know, we're no longer panicked because the whole week has gone. You know, and it sums up the various opinions of various journalists, but you know they're reduced to a sentence or two each, which is really adequate.
Do they ever just put, and the Daily Mail thinks what you'd imagine, and so does the Guardian. They just fill in the, you probably know what they think. Do you need to have
they put in the actual words.
They should
push
that to its conclusion. They should do it a year later.
this time last year,
this is what you missed, and you know it's fine now. Don't worry.
But
about
it's more. Right. But it's more. It's more international, which I like. You get a you know. You've got a whole section on America, you've got a whole section on Europe, and then you go to world other. You know, but you do have a, you know, then you go to, and then they take the best articles from certain international newspapers. I just like getting a sort of broader.
That sounds quite good. That's kind of what I'm,
kind of broader but more concise. And I can read the whole thing over the weekend, you know, every time I sit down and have food, basically. So my breakfasts and things. And then I get a sense of, okay, that's where we are right now. You know, to go any deeper into it, I find very depressing. You know, do I want to see pictures of horror from Syria? Not really, you know, because that just puts me off my game. It just totally throws me. I'll get very upset about it. I won't feel like writing novels has any point to it whatsoever. Yeah. And actually writing novels is what, you know, or writing generally is what
you
do. It's my whole,
that.
Yeah, it is my kind of, my fundamental purpose, as opposed to getting upset about things that I can have no influence.
Was it always what you meant to be, what you meant to do? Because obviously there are two, is it two collections, poetry collections?
Well, two with Anvil and one which was a commission, so there's technically
which is
three. I'll give it to you, Simon. It's Not the Usual Grass is Singing, and it's A Journey Around the Isle of Shepping.
That's
it's
right.
The
yeah,
four
yeah,
walls
I knew you did.
Shepping.
I knew you did. I don't think
you
I knew
haven't
it
seen
was
the
actually
book.
A book.
Yeah, yeah.
You
it is
do
a
have
book.
The book, you know?
No, I've got the other two.
Really?
Definitely.
Okay. Well, if you ever feel like going to the Isle of Shepping and doing the walks, they're site specific poems, and you can go around and.
If I read them.
You won't need to. If you read them, you'll think, I'll not go to Sheerness then.
If I do that, if I close read them, like in the 1930s, do I just then not have to? If I read them in a postmodern, if I kind of see them as psychogeographic, I probably have to go and do the walk so I can so I can be a reader of them and mesh my own experience with the text. But I don't really go in for all that sort of nonsense.
No, actually,
I prefer Empson, and I would just like to close read them.
Okay,
tease out the meaning of every verb. And then not go.
Well, that sounds like a good plan, actually, Simon. So
I'll do that.
You're very
I'll
welcome
do
to do that.
Excellent.
But yeah,
I've
no, the plan was always to since very early. I started writing my first novel when I was at uni, and I'd wanted to be a writer, not a poet, but a writer since I was, well, I don't know when. Since I was born, probably. Mm. Since I was aware, you know. Taught myself to write, even though my mother refused to teach me. I taught myself by tracing the letters of the Empress Nightingale when I was supposed to be having a nap, so I could read and write before I went to school. And only because I knew the stories that I was read so well that I worked out what the words were. And writing was a really big part of it. I got my first prize for writing. I got Books of Smarties from my head teacher when I was six. I thought, this is cool. I write, I get sweeties. I will keep doing it. Maybe I'll get more sweeties. Yes. But yeah, I wrote...
All the sweeties right now.
Yeah. So I started writing my first novel when I was at uni and realised I didn't have enough experience to make it.
I wrote good. 3 novels when I was at university and they were all terrible. Yeah.
And I didn't finish that one, and then I wrote another unfinished one, and then I finished one.
Yeah.
Eventually, and then I wrote 3 more, and then I did another half of one. Because the
and
three.
Then you sacked your agent.
Well, I got really close with Complete Novel 2 and Complete Novel 3.
Hmm.
I got really close, and you know I had an agent, and I had a lot of you know really quite strong interest from one publisher in particular for the second one. I thought he said he loved every word of it, wouldn't change a word of it, but it had to get complete sign off across HarperCollins because he was chief at Flamingo, no longer there. And it didn't, the UK sales director couldn't see how to market it because as usual I was doing something slightly outside the standard boxes and they didn't know what to make of it really. The salespeople, so it didn't go. And then the second one had 3 lots of interest and didn't go. And then I started the third one and applied for funding from Southeast Arts. And Kieran Phelan said to me, what's to say you're not writing another unpublishable novel? And I thought, well, you've got a point.
This Kieran is what's to say that.
You've got a point. So at that point, I thought, well, maybe I just can't do it. You know, I can write novels. People really like them. The editors all really liked them, but they weren't obviously marketable because they're a bit quirky.
Mm.
And then, you know, strangely, I've ended up writing something even quirkier.
Yeah.
When it has got through and it has got published.
I suppose you can sum up its weirdness quite quickly. That's what I'll say, is that you can explain what is wrong with it really easily.
What is wrong with it?
Well, you know, in terms of people go, I like books, but I don't like anything weird. And if it's going to be weird, I want to know exactly what is weird about it. And, you know, you can say to those people, right, well, it's inverse in iambic pentameter and it's about this.
It's about the Shakespeare authorship.
Like, it's a difficult concept, but it's not a difficult concept to grasp. It's like Fermat's Last Theorem.
Yeah, you can sum it up in a sentence and that makes it marketable.
I think that's the key, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
There's ease of summing up the weirdness, I suppose.
That makes me worry about the book I'm writing on now.
It's easy to sum up the next one because it's the next novel from Ross Barber. It's easy once you've got one.
Yeah, that's right.
So you don't even have to say what it's about now. You're just like, oh, Ross, acclaimed author, done this.
Yeah, what worries me is that I have to do something different from the Marlowe Papers because I cannot do that again. I mean, I'm not invited to write another novel in verse because they are very difficult to sell and it's got to be a one-off. So it's not in verse, and then I didn't want to get put into the historical novelist box, so it's not historical. And then you wonder whether the people who like the Marlowe Papers will like anything about this. You know, have I left everything that was the Marlowe Papers?
Is it the kind of thing where I can ask you what it's about, or is that not the kind of thing that we're answering yet?
Well, I can tell you, because I'm more than halfway through, but I have to say it makes me a bit nervous. So, you know, I haven't got my elevator pitch, I can't put it in a line.
Okay. Well, I don't
know. You can ask me about it.
What's
want.
It about? Just there we are. Forget.
It's about a criminal psychologist who is assessing a young woman's sanity, and she is accused of a very serious religiously motivated crime.
Mm-hmm.
And it's set very marginally in the future, at a time when there are moves to classify any kind of fundamentalism on the religious scale as madness. So
interesting.
That sounds interesting.
Richard Dawkins dislike it?
Well,
it sounds like the kind of thing you might dislike a little bit.
Yes. Well, yes, he might.
Yeah.
Dislike it quite a lot, but. It's not so obvious. I've actually done something with the structure where basically the man makes a decision and he chooses to go one way or the other way, and I'm making him go both.
Okay, that'll do. Yeah, I don't want to hear anymore. Anything else is spoilers. Let's stop there.
Okay,
that sounds very good.
Yeah,
sci-fi. You're not allowed to say
speculative fiction. I have to do a Margaret Atwood on you and say speculative fiction. It's literary fiction, therefore it's no genre, you know. Yeah. Like my last one wasn't historical fiction, it's no genre, it's literary fiction. But, you know, the Marlowe Papers has been classified as historical, it's been classified as crime. I got invited to a crime writer's day. It's obviously a thriller. Yeah. It's also a romance, you know, so there's a love story element. Yeah. So you can do a lot of cross-genre. I think that's always been my issue before with the novels that didn't get placed, is they were kind of cross-genre. Mm. And when you're a bit cross-genre, it can be hard to know what to do.
Was it for the best?
Yes. Yeah. It was for the best. I'm really glad that they got turned down.
Right.
Because I remember one of the rejections that I got that said, she can really write, but in order to make an impact, she'll have to do more than this comedy of manners and errors. Mm. And it's about making a splash, and you have to make a... Yeah. You know, there's so many books being published, and you can imagine how many people's first novels were published last year. A lot, you know, thousands. I mean, not just the big publishers, but the small publishers and the self-publishing. So how does your name rise to the top of that, you know, enormous number of people who want their novels to be read? You have to have something that creates an impact. And I don't think that those earlier books would make enough impact. Not quite enough.
Yeah, that's good. Kind of good to hear.
Yes. Came at the right time in the end. I mean, later than I'd wished, but actually came at the right time for me. And I don't think I had...
Because I realised I didn't want to be a novelist. And it was kind of something that I thought I'd wanted to be, and realised I didn't actually want to be a novelist. And I don't really like novels. and it kind of... That wasn't really something I knew, because I kind of... I mean, I always wanted to make things. And it's really what I wanted, to make complete packages. And really, I mean, I want to write musicals. But, like, you know, basically, I didn't want to be a novelist, and I wrote novels thinking I did. And I did kind of come to me that, like, thinking, well, I don't really like novels very much as a form. It's not my favourite form. And maybe I don't actually want to write them, and should probably stop thinking I will, because I've got better things for me that I'd rather do. And
yeah.
So, you know, I don't know, did you ever want to be a novelist? Because you really don't think it's worth writing unless it's only three lines long and about a pointy
much.
Leaf.
Yeah, well...
Because you are an imagist.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think so. I don't think I wanted to be an English teacher, just because I wanted people to get off my back and stop telling me what I needed to be when I was at school. I remember, you know, like when they make you decide what you're going to do. I didn't want to decide.
So you told them that?
I just told them that. Then I went to Birmingham, stayed for 5 weeks and then quit, because I realised I didn't want to be there and it wasn't my cup of tea. And there were lots of women there, and they were all... exactly as you'd expect them to be in an English literature class. They were talking all the time about things, and I didn't like it. So I oh God, I can't do this. Like, it's like there was like one guy, and I find lots of women in a room very difficult anyway. And I just panicked and just went, I can't do this. This is ridiculous. And then a few people fell in love with me, and then I left.
So much. You made an impact.
I was 18, and I think there was a couple of people, and they
discovered your true calling, which was to be seen departing from doors by men in love.
Pretty much, yeah.
It's a pretty good calling.
Really good at that.
And then I came back here, and then I met Simon pretty much a couple of months later, and then started doing other stuff. Mm. But I've never really been able to pick, which is really difficult, I think, not being able to pick. But I still can't pick. I can't decide which thing I really want to do. But like Simon, I really like to make stuff and make stuff happen.
Yeah.
I just find it hard to sell it to a larger market. That's the thing that neither of us are very good at. We're not very good at selling to a big, big market. We need someone to do it for us. That's the one thing.
It's the one that there are gates in place to prevent people from doing it. We've recently got down to our last 20 copies of David Koresh Superstar, which was really surprising, because I kind of think of that as a failure.
Artistic success? No, I think of it creative as
a, I think,
success.
A sort of qualified artistic success, in that it takes people too long to get what I'm on about. And like, I thought it was really, really obvious why that was a good idea. Like, I genuinely thought, why wouldn't that? Because my reaction to the idea, when I had the idea, was obviously that's perfect. It fits everything. Ah,
laughed
in an evil way for a while. and actually, I think most people were just like, why have you done that?
love it.
Well, because for me, it's like concept albums, this ridiculous form of concept albums, which is a fundamentally stupid thing to do.
Yeah.
But they're all about about messiahs.
Yes.
Like, there's quite a lot of them about Jesus himself, and then all the others are about, like, space messiahs, or, like, that's the kind of... Because it... And Tommy, you know, is a messiah, and it's, like, yes. It's all about these ideas of these false messiahs being the perfect thing to write a content about. And when you do it with an actual false messiah, and then it was supposed to be this, because it's Jesus, it's like Jesus Christ Superstar, but if you know right from the start and everyone agrees that he's not the Son of God, what is that story about? And it's the same story, it's a passion, but Jesus Christ Superstar has kind of got this baggage of, well, you might actually be the Son of God, but if you accept right from the start that that definitely isn't true, then it's kind of a really messed up story. So I thought, well, that's a story worth telling. And
It was a story. I think maybe
if I just stopped at the beginning, like track one, and been, right, this is what's about to happen. This is what I'm going for. And in order to understand it, these are the points you need to follow.
Yeah.
I reckon then...
A prologue. It's a prologue.
Yeah. But I think I didn't do that.
Once people get it, they really love it, I think. I think one of the best reviews we had was from a Christian magazine in America. And they were reviewing it along with the Book of Mormon. Yeah. It was just very balanced, very even.
I think because they probably looked at it as something which was likely to offend them, so they spent really bothered to try and work out what it was.
And they didn't seem to be offended by it. I think they liked that it was, that it had detail, a bit like the Book of Job. Like Christian, you never offended a Christian with the Book of Job because there's so much detail in it, and it's all there.
It sticks to the story
pretty much. Yeah.
I mean, because you'll get like
with a bit of swearing.
Yeah. Your atheists will go, I bet Christians hate that. Well, they don't actually.
No. Yeah.
You'd be surprised. Yeah. They tend not to.
Not as much as you hate them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't believe in God. I kind of have stopped calling myself an atheist because I just don't really feel the need to join clubs. Not really a joiner.
No.
But I mean, it certainly was interesting with Job, whereas you would get a reaction from non-believers that, well, this is bound to offend Christians because it exposes them. And Christians are like, yeah, these are the problems I've wrestled with. This is why I ended up a Christian.
Yeah.
And I've kind of thought, well, that's a mental way to go as far as I'm concerned. But I don't, I'm glad that... Because I think it does, it wrestles with the same problems that people who end up religious wrestle with. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, I follow the Battlestar Galactica view. Have you seen Battlestar Galactica? It's my favourite thing in the world. Probably.
Paul's watched it all.
He has, yeah.
Because like the base, well, this is a spoiler, but the base.
Don't say it. Okay. You'll get killed.
Will I?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
We can't discuss it.
It's obviously set in space and stuff, but it's kind of...
Oh no,
that's not a spoiler. That's fairly obvious.
Oh God.
But like they're very delicately step around these kind of ideas in a very human way, and they kind of come to conclusions in a very human way, and I think that's why I like it so much.
Check.
It's brilliant. It's really brilliant.
Yeah. Okay, so are you going to do your segment that you do? Because we keep trying to have this segment.
Well, I've got a very short one this time.
This is the segment where Julia reads out a text from her family and everyone goes, Christ.
Well, this one's really short and it just goes, God, it's cold up your skirt.
So more of that next week. Would you like to read something else? Or...
I could do.
That would be delightful.
And then we could talk about online reviewing, perhaps.
And then we'll do that, yes.
Just a moment. The problem is not marking the page. That's the problem. No, there it is. Look, it's a short one.
Oh.
Ish. Shortish.
Read it really slowly, then. Just...
Oh, really?
So that people have got the opportunity for close textual analysis.
Okay.
And none of this, don't interpret this in your postmodern way. I'm not interested in your view. Close textual analysis to find out what she really means. That's the only proper way to listen to this.
I think it's very easy to get. I don't think it needs that.
If you were sitting there going, oh, Roland Barthes, death of the author. She's not dead. I can see her. she's right there, and she's definitely alive. So,
Well, I'm reading this specifically for my friend Nicola Hayden because she really loves this one. So, Alpine Letter. Love. If you'd asked me yesterday, I'd say, love is a sore that amputates the heart. I'd call it my disease. I'd call it plague. But yesterday, I hadn't heard from you. So call it the weight of light that holds one soul connected to another, or a tear that falls in all gratitude, becoming sea. Call it the only word that comforts me. The sight of your writing has me on the floor, the curve of each letter looped about my heart, and in this ink, the tenor of your voice, and in this ink, the movement of your hand. The Alps now cut their teeth upon the sky, and pressing on to set these granite jaws between us, not a mile will do me harm. Your letter in my coat will keep me warm.
We have to do our little
clapping.
Of course, there's email now. So
I know. Yeah. This is the, how this is what it's saying. It's saying, wasn't it great when we used to get lovely handwritten letters? You see, you don't have the thing of the knowing that the person actually touched the page and the you know all of that that you miss out on with letters. So
Simon was never much of a letter writer. He used to type them out and print them out.
I used to. Well, you're so you're born after the era of letters, really.
I did write letters.
I
have to tell you the year that you were born, and I know when that was. I was writing a lot of letters. I had a whole stack full of letters writing to my boyfriend who lived about 20 miles away. We were always daily.
Yeah.
I'd get a letter, I'd send him, you know, and then the next day I'd get one back, and it was serious correspondence.
Do you remember using landlines?
Yes.
we haven't done that for a long time. I remember when I was a teenager.
AOL chat. Go on.
Remember LinkedIn?
I try not to. I never joined LinkedIn.
When I was a teenager, I didn't have a mobile phone yet because it was just about to happen where everyone got mobile phones. It was like 2 years away and we were still using landlines. And I was going out with this guy at school, didn't go very well. And he didn't talk very much. And so I used to make this really long list of things that I could ask him on the telephone so that we could have a conversation, in inverted commas. I used to get through it so fast because he didn't talk. And I was like, why doesn't he talk? What is this problem? Why is he not communicating? I appreciate he might be mysterious, but at some point he's going to have to say something. And he just used to say yes and no, and I'd get through my list, and then that would be the end of the conversation. And that's what I remember about using landlines.
Do you remember any of the
questions? I've probably got them written down somewhere, you know.
I bet you do.
Are you doing any music today? I can't mention who it is, obviously, but, like, are you... how are your parents? What are you up to? Oh, are you going to smoke some weed today? That kind of thing. Like, like just, you know, anything to try and have a conversation. It was just pointless. Lasted 3 weeks. Ended. And I never got to kiss him.
And so that's covered bastard. Your whole experience of landlines.
Well, that's kind of what I remember about
and relationships. It's being, she's got a list every time I come in.
I really got into text messages as soon as that was a possibility because I could be precise and clear and that would be that, and I could send exactly what I wanted to say, whereas phone conversations I never particularly liked anyway.
I don't particularly like phone conversations, do
I? I don't like not seeing
I much yet. Prefer someone to email me than ring me.
Yeah.
Isn't it a terrible fact that HD and text messages didn't coincide historically?
Absolutely. That's what I always think, yeah.
Why?
Because she'd been brilliant at that.
Hilda Doolittle, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Imagine.
It's a historical
and
tragedy.
And Twitter, too. Twitter.
Born too soon.
Yeah. Yeah. I did try and do like images poems on Twitter, but
HD on Twitter.
Yeah, Paul and I, our relationship was forged with text messages, and that was the first time that had happened in any. You know, texting was very new when we first got together, and I hadn't actually learned how to use the text facility on my phone. That's how bad it was, and he showed me how to do it, and then we flirted by text.
That's beautiful, man.
That's how long ago we got together.
It doesn't seem that long ago to me. Because I didn't get into text messaging for a long time. I got worried. I didn't want to.
No, I didn't know. I had this little symbol on my phone. I had a little envelope, and I said, "But what's that?" He said, "It means you've got mail. Like people have been texting you." Really? What's texting? Okay.
Wow.
That was 13 years ago. We're talking 13 years.
It really isn't very long. Things go very fast. They do
these days. Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose you could, like. I think you could probably compare it with the Industrial Revolution, couldn't you, in some respects, like in terms of how fast, like comparably how fast things went.
It is faster,
but like cause I know a little bit about it because of photography history, and like photography history is like it comparatively happened very quickly because of course it was scientific and chemical, and so like all it's really fascinating. If anyone's ever interested in looking into photography history, it's fascinating.
I suppose the thing
is, it's so context specific, like it's so about one very particular thing, and all the history kind of goes into it and becomes involved in it in different ways. But it's not specific to art, or it's all, you know, all different kinds, like war photography and art photography and and medical photography and all this kind of stuff intersects with this history in a really fascinating
way. I think that really brought home the speed was like when that Facebook thing happened, they had, and suddenly people could see messages that they thought were private. And actually, because the explanation was true, it just was completely mental because you couldn't imagine how Facebook was when that was happening. Because when I look back, and I was like, God, those really are private messages, but they absolutely weren't private messages. They were wall posts before there was a wall. So they were public, but Facebook just didn't work that way then. And like, but I couldn't, we could barely imagine what Facebook used to look like when those messages were being sent. And
that was in 2008.
And it was like, you know, but it, really it changed so ago, fast, like, it was just it was crazy.
Incredible. Let's talk about reviews.
Oh yes, reviews. Online reviewing in particular. Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is your revenge.
Well, I just, it's just bizarre some of the reviews that you get, and it's been, and I know they say you shouldn't read your reviews, but how can you not? I mean, how can you not?
I don't know.
I know, I mean.
I do all that. I'm the.
You read them. Well, it's new. I probably have to stop.
I had to stop.
I can see that. I can see why you would. I mean, you know, the nice ones are nice, but when you
get... I hate them too. They are just as bad. The nice ones upset me as much.
Do
because
they?
They'll get one thing, like,
they
a
didn't
tiny
get
bit
it.
Wrong.
Yeah, they didn't get it right.
And then I'll sort of care about it. And I don't care. And I, you know...
Okay, so some of the ones that I really... well, made me laugh, actually. There was an Amazon one-star review. It was the first one-star review I'd had, and I'd had all really good reviews. And then I had a one-star review that said... it said that it was doggerel, and then it said this author needs to be stabbed in the eye.
In the eye?
Yeah, as Marlowe
but
was.
But that won't stop
stabbed
you writing.
In the eye.
Oh, I see. Oh, yes, of course.
This author needs to be stabbed in the eye. And the last time I looked, 9 out of 20 people found that helpful.
Because which I imagine they were sitting there going, you know, this author does need to be stabbed, but it needs to be in a kind of in context.
Yeah.
A stabbing without a literary reference won't work. No. Where should we stab it?
And in the eye, helpful. Like Marlowe.
It is helpful.
Very helpful. Yeah. And the other one, there was a Goodreads, I think it was either one or two.
So
I think
Goodreads,
it was one star. I really hate Goodreads. I detest Goodreads. And I'm only on it because my American publisher insisted that I was on it. But there was a one star review on Goodreads that said, I'm too thick for this book. And I thought, well, give yourself one star then. You're mocking yourself, you know, and you put it on my book. It's not right, is it?
Yeah.
But also because Goodreads does something, and I think it does it surreptitiously, as far as I can tell, because it somehow, I mean, I think I must have put my email address in it, signing up, in the signing up process, not realising what would happen. Then it gets hold of everyone in your address book, and if any of them are on Goodreads, then they're kind of, suddenly you're connected to them as friends. I've got lots of Goodreads friends in inverted commas, and one of these, the trouble is that if someone's your friend and then they review your book and you're a Goodreads author, their review then becomes the first thing you see every time you sign in to Goodreads. And one of my so-called friends wrote a stinking review of the book, which just every time I signed in just popped up there to tell me how shit my book was and how miserable, and they would have written it completely differently, and they, you know, and so, well, they're obviously not my friend, so I then unfriended them or defriended them, whatever the correct verb is. But I just, I hate it, and I don't want to be constantly messaged with what someone's read this week that I don't even know. I mean, my so-called friends, they've been automatically connected to me, and I probably know about 10 of them. And the rest of them I don't know, and I don't really care. I don't really care what they're reading. I don't really care what they think about what they're reading.
I think if you're really impressed when someone has read a book, you're kind of...
Yeah, I go, well, I've read some books too, you know. I put in some books that I had read, and they were all kind of classics and things that I read years ago, really, because I just said, what have I read, aren't you? Because I had to I had to find a way of complaining about the fact that they didn't have the cover. I had to get hold of...
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to even ask the question about how could my cover be put up for my book, unless I had a certain standing on Goodreads, which meant I had to have entered books and rated them.
Amazing.
And then someone actually... I think I'd given 5 stars to George Orwell's 1984, and I'd given 4 to Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. And someone I don't know sent me a message on Goodreads saying, why only 4 stars for Brave New World compared with 5 for 1984?
Well, I find that impossible, because you get that on Facebook now, it asks you if you've read things, and you go, yes, I've read that, and I've read that. And then, like, later on, it asks you to rate it. And it's sort of like, oh, how many stars would you give a very Brady sequel? And you were like, well, five, obviously, because it's amazing. And then, you know, how many stars would you give Robocop 2? Oh, you know, sort of middling, three. And then it's like, how many stars would you give Paradise Lost? It's like, I can't judge these things on the same scale.
No, I don't Paradise feel, Lost, like...
I don't feel capable of giving a star rating to Paradise Lost anyway, but giving a star rating with reference to Robocop 2, that's yeah. impossible. No. There's no way I can do that.
But I could see why the person who wrote me this note... thinks that there are some similarities, you know, like, oh, well, they can maybe put them in the same bracket to be judged yes. together. But the point is, you know, why do they care whether I've given this five and that four? You know, I politely replied and said, because 1984 has made a bigger long-term impression. But it's so long since I've read both of them that I really don't know what I would, you know, do now. It's just that 1984 really, really stuck with me.
Yes.
In the way that Brave New World didn't, although I remember it making quite an impact at the time, but it hasn't been such a lasting impact, but it's still an excellent book.
That's
four
a lot
stars.
Of detail to have gone
you know,
into.
Do I really... But why are you contacting me about this? Do, you know, and have you not got anything better to do? Because, you know, I've got books to write. And that's the difficulty that I have with social media, is that there are aspects of it I like and there are aspects of it that are necessary. But, you know, I'm a bit ADD. I have enough trouble focusing on things as it is. I have a lot of, you know, a bit of a split attention problem. And then people want to complete strangers want to correspond with you. That's why I like Twitter, because it's short. I'm yeah. very happy to have contact with people on Twitter. It hasn't got abusive on my end yet, and if it does happen,
probably will now. After all,
I will probably feel quite differently about it and may quit it. But I have enjoyed the contact with readers that I've had through that, and with all kinds of folk, people who aren't necessarily readers.
I used to like Twitter. I think it's.
You've been at the sharp end of it, though. Haven't
not
you?
So much on Twitter. I mean, we have been on the sharp, because like Nick Cohen said he liked us once, and that was enough, because he's a left-wing journalist who was roughly was vaguely in favour of the Iraq War, and being liked by him is enough to provoke reams of abuse on the internet. Yeah. But to this day, there's still one. Like, there was a bloke going around for a little while. I think I've talked about him before, but he would just put anything that we were involved in anywhere on the internet. He would find a way of commenting on it. It was just one bloke. It was like Resistor 27 or something. He'd be like, fighting the fight. We were like the forces of capitalism, and he was destroying us very slowly.
Probably like Billy Bragg or something.
By commenting on like comment 253 on the NME forum or whatever.
Yeah.
And he like. Yeah, it's just really unpleasant. But I just think, but at the same time, though, I'm really pro trolling. I think trolling's excellent on the whole. I mean, they can go into a situation where it gets overly nasty and people can do things which are criminal. But on the whole, I think there is a sort of despicable media elite in this country, and they act, and whose job is essentially to troll people by provoking their opinions. And I'm using trolling the way that it's supposed to be used, meaning to deliberately cause people to be. Well, but
to react, yeah.
And you know, that is what the columnists do, and the fact that people disagree with them isn't trolling. And you sort of see this thing a few years ago where people were engaging in criminal harassment, which is already illegal, and then people who I've seen in the past referring to trolls as people who just disagree with them on the internet going, oh, it must be stopped. It's like, well, yes, that must be stopped because it's criminal, but what you want to stop is people disagreeing with you and, you know, worrying your little herd of media elite people centred around the New Statesman. I've got no time for that whatsoever. Yeah. So it's just a really dangerous thing.
I think it's a shame that people... They're very humourless, which I find kind of... This is kind of how I deal with it now. Because it used to upset me when I was a teenager. It used to upset me. And I'd go down to the beach and I'd ride my bike and I'd be like, oh my God, you hate my stuff. Oh my God, I'm so depressed about it. And I'd cry and I'd be really cross about it. And now I just kind of think, why are you so humourless about this stuff? If you question anything that they say, suddenly you're like their number one enemy, and it might just be that you want to have a chat with them and talk about it. I just call them a potato and they get really cross with me, and I'm just like, a potato, or like really, really infantile stuff, because as far as I'm concerned, being humourless about things that are just conversation is ridiculous. You should always try and find a common ground if you can, because most people have the same basic needs.
Well, years ago, when we first started out doing music at all, we had that Pete Doherty song, and like, you know, we'd get email from obsessive Pete Doherty fans going, oh, why are you just trying to get famous on these coattails and stuff? And I was kind of like, well observed, but at the same time, no, that was never part of it. But you know, and I would write them like essay length you know, this is why, this is the true meaning of my genius versus... And then, but Julia, like once, someone sent one to the MySpace that we used to have. Remember MySpace back in the old days? And she sent one to MySpace going, oh, you fucking cunts, doctoring that. And she just went, yeah, fuck off, you wanker. And he was like, oh, I'm really sorry.
I said, fuck off. It's not about wanting him to die, actually. It's about the media and that wanting him to die. So actually, it's like pro-doctory, so whatever, you cunt. And then he was like, oh, right, yeah, no, I understand now.
just called him a cunt. Like, and then he was like, oh, it's fine.
I was like, you know, I'm not having this. And it worked. It worked perfectly well, because I just went, right, how do we communicate with this person? We do it this way.
Call him a cunt.
Exactly. Worked a treat. And I think that was me finding common ground with him, just going, right, well, how... You know,
well, you're using the same language.
Basically, so, yeah. But, like, I wasn't pretending or anything. I was clarifying, but in an easy, simple way. I think, you know, I think you've got to have a bit of a thick skin with this stuff. It can be really hurtful, but at the same time...
No, if it's criminal harassment, if someone's threatening to rape you, then that's illegal and they should...
Yeah, just don't do that.
But I think it's when people kind of... I don't know. I thought it got hijacked by the worst people in the country.
Just stop telling people what they can think and say.
We've been doing this for ages. We've done considerably more than we did with the other people.
Really? Well, we must stop.
And normally with the other people, we sort of would go off into tangents that we had to edit out. But I think I'm keeping all of this today. So.
Well, even the chats about our private friends and, you know, knows.
No,
yeah.
Well, that's going in. do you have anything to finish off?
I don't think so.
Let's just stop.
I don't know. I don't think so. We've got people queue up the song. We've done the song that people queued up for this week, so could do another one. But what would we do?
We Hate the Kids.
Well, someone has queued that one up, but we haven't practiced it.
No.
I know, and we know that practice
does make better. Not perfect.
But we do know this one quite well, so.
I don't really remember how to play it, but it's fine. I'm sure it'll work. Let's play it.
And then... it works with all the cup discussion we've just been having, really, doesn't it?
Well, again, because this is the main thing, is people request these songs from my first album, which I really don't really think those things so much anymore.
But you got to carry on. Imagine how the Stones feel.
I do still hate the kids, though, so that's...
Yeah, that's all right, then, isn't it?
Yeah,
imagine. This is you do it with feeling.
This is for Graham Isherwood, I think.
I've got the lyrics. Generation gets fooled again, and every generation is the same. And it's, I don't agree with that anymore, actually, because this new generation is worse than this generation. When I wrote this, I thought, all generations are the same, they're all as bad as each other. And then you see this generation now. Oh, dear.
You're talking about my sons.
Probably. No, not really. I don't know.
They're part of this generation.
Yeah, but they're... I take it back. They're the good bit. They're the exception.
And
there's always exceptions.
And it's no good saying it's not in your name, because it is in... I've actually put an italic in the lyric book there, because it is in your name. Yeah. Let's just do this with audio footnotes.
I like this. I like this version, yeah.
Yeah. And this generation is the same, and this not generation is to blame. And I'm sorry that I can't join in anymore. I've been let down too many times before. Oh yeah, we mean it. We hate the kids. So dance to this radio tonight. Get high. We've found men who once met
drunk to get set on fire. And there's always a crackhead charismatic liar. And there's always a teenager due to expire. And there's always a
teenager due to expire.
He had a beginning, it grew and it was tended. And now it is rotten, let it be ended. Let every hug this case and every charm unoffended. Every satellite and every student attended. Every journey and leaguer, identity seeker. Every junkie and drinker, and every loudspeaker. Be done with parlor, toss satellite. No more music, thank you and good night.
There we are.
Great.
Thank you very much for holding my lyric book, Ruth. And thank you very much for being on our podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
That was good. That was a bit more serious than the other ones. Ah. It was good. It went into depth, which I think people would prefer.
Okay.
Yeah. Prefer it, people.
Yes. If they don't prefer it.
Well. Tough. There was something else next week.
Yes. So thank you very much. I'm done with this. I wired it at that point. Julia, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
We'll say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.